Trying not to hurry, she walked in his direction, leaving Swan still gobbling. A pretty black-haired serving man, whose bulky woolen breeches could not quite hide neatly turned calves, offered Swan a steaming silver cup from a tray. Other servants were moving about with other silver trays. Refreshment was being offered, if a bit late. It was much too late for the kiss of peace. She did not hear what Swan said as she snatched a cup, but from the way the fellow jerked and started bobbing bows, he had received sharp shards of her temper at the least. Egwene sighed. Talmanis stood with arms folded, observing the goings-on with an amused smile that did not reach his eyes. He seemed poised to explode into motion, but his eyes were tired. At her approach he made a respectful leg, but there was a wry touch to his voice when he said, "You changed a border today." He gathered his cloak against the icy breeze. "It has always been fluid between Andor and Murundi, no matter what maps say, but Andor has never come south in such numbers before. Except for the Aiel War and the White Cloak War, anyway, but they were only passing through then. Once they have been here a month, new maps will show a new line. Look at the Murandians scramble, fawning over Pelavar and his companions as much as they do the sisters. They are hoping to make new friends for the new day." To Egwene, trying to conceal her careful watch on those who might be watching her, it seemed that all of the nobles, Murandian and Andoran, were intent on the sitters, crowding around them. In any case, she had slightly more important matters in mind than borders, to her, if not to the nobles. Except for brief moments, none of the sitters were visible beyond the tops of their heads. Only Halima and Swan seemed to notice her, and a babble like that of a flock of excited geese filled the air. She lowered her voice and chose her words carefully. "Friends are always important, Talmanis. You've been a good friend to Matt, and I think to me. I hope that hasn't changed. I hope you've not told anyone what you shouldn't." Light, she was anxious, or she would not have been so direct. Next, she would come right out and ask what he and Pelavar had been talking about. Luckily, he did not laugh at her for a blunt-tongued village woman, though he might have been thinking it. He studied her seriously before speaking, in a soft voice. He also knew caution. Not all men gossip. "Tell me, when you sent Matt south, did you know what you would do here today?"
"How could I know that 2 months ago?"
"No, Aes Sedai aren't omniscient, Talmanis." She had hoped for something that would put her in the place she was, had planned for it, but she had not known, not back then. She also hoped he did not gossip. Some men did not. Romanda started toward her with a firm stride and a frozen face, but Arathel intercepted her, catching the yellow sitter's arm and refusing to be put off, despite Romanda's astonishment. "Will you at least tell me where Matt is?" Talmanis asked. "On his way to Camelin with the daughter heir? Why are you surprised? A serving woman will speak to a soldier when fetching water from the same stream, even when he is a horrible dragon sworn," he added dryly. Light! Men really were inconvenient at times. The best of them found ways to say exactly the wrong thing at the wrong moment, to ask the wrong question, not to mention inveigling serving women into prattle. So much easier if she could just lie, but he had given her plenty of room within the oaths. Half the truth would suffice and keep him from herring off to Ebu Dar, maybe less than half. Over in the far corner of the pavilion, Swan stood conversing with a tall young redhead with curled mustaches, who was eyeing her as dubiously as Segan had. Nobles usually knew the look of Aes Sedai, but he held only a part of Swan's attention. Her gaze constantly flickered toward Egwene. It seemed to shout, loud as conscience, easier, expedient, what it was to be Aes Sedai. She had not known about today, only hoped. Egwene expelled an irritated breath. Burn the woman. "He was in Ebu Dar the last I heard," she muttered. "But he must be hurrying north as fast as he can by now. He still thinks he has to save me, Talmanis, and Matrim Cawthon wouldn't miss the chance to be on the spot so he can say I told you so." Talmanis did not look at all surprised. "I thought it might be so," he sighed. "I have felt something for weeks now. Others in the band have, too. Not urgent, but always there, as if he needed me. As if I should look south, anyway. It can be peculiar, following a Taviran."
I suppose it can, she agreed, hoping none of her incredulity showed. It was strange enough to think of Matt the Wastrel as leader of the Band of the Red Hand, much less as Taviran. But surely a Taviran had to be present nearby, at least, to have any effect. Matt was wrong about you needing rescue. You never had any intention of coming to me for help, did you? He still spoke softly, but she looked around hurriedly anyway. Swan was still watching them, and so was Halima. Piter stood much too close to her, puffing and preening and stroking his mustaches. From the way he stared down her dress, he had not mistaken her for a sister, that was certain. But she was giving him only half her mind, darting sidelong glances in Egwene's direction while she smiled up at him warmly. Everyone else appeared occupied, and no one stood close enough to hear. The Ammerlin Seat could hardly go running for sanctuary, now could she? But there have been times it's been a comfort knowing you were there, she admitted, reluctantly. The Ammerlin Seat was hardly supposed to need a bolt hole, but it could do no harm, so long as none of the sitters knew. You have been a friend, Talmanis. I hope that continues. I truly do.
You have been more open with me than I expected, he said slowly. So I will tell you something.
His face did not change. To any watcher, he must have seemed as casual as before, but his voice dropped to a whisper. I have had approaches from King Roedran about the band. It seems he has hopes of being Murindi's first real king. He wants to hire us. I would not have considered it normally, but there is never enough coin, and with this feel of Matt needing us, it might be better if we remain in Murindi. Clear as good glass, you are where you want to be and have everything in hand.
He fell silent as a young serving woman curtsied to offer mulled wine. She wore finely embroidered green wool and a cloak plush with spotted rabbit. Other servants from the camp were helping out now as well, no doubt for something to do besides stand and shiver. The young woman's round face was decidedly pinched from the cold. Talmanis waved her off and pulled his cloak back around him, but Egwene took a silver cup to gain a moment for thought. Truly there was little need for the band any longer. Despite all the muttering, the sisters took their presence as a matter of course now, dragon-sworn or not. They no longer feared an attack, and there had been no real need to use the band's presence to prod them into moving since leaving Salidar. The only true purpose Shen and Kalhar served now was to draw recruits into Bryn's army, men who thought two armies meant a battle and wanted to be on the side with the greatest numbers. She had no need of them, but Talmanis had acted as a friend, and she was Ammerlin. Sometimes friendship and responsibility pushed in the same direction. As the serving woman moved off, Egwene laid a hand on Talmanis's arm. You must not do that. Even the band can't conquer all of Murindi by itself, and every hand will be against you. You know very well the one thing that makes Murandians stand together as foreigners on their soil. Follow us to Tar Valon, Talmanis. Matt will come there, I have no doubt of that. Matt would not really believe she was the Ammerlin until he saw her wearing the stole in the White Tower. Roedran is no fool, he said placidly. All he wants us to do is sit and wait. A foreign army, without Aes Sedai, and nobody knowing what it is up to. He should not have much trouble uniting the nobles against us. Then, so he says, we quietly slip across the border. He thinks he can hold on to them afterward. She could not stop a touch of heat entering her voice. And what is to stop him betraying you? If the threat goes away without a fight, his dream of a united Murindi might too. The fool man seemed amused. I am not a fool, either. Roedran cannot be ready before spring. This lot would never have stirred from their manors if the Andorans had not come south, and they were on the march before the snows began. Before then, Matt will find us. If he is coming north, he must hear of us. Roedran will have to be satisfied with whatever he has managed by then. So if Matt does intend to go to Tar Valon, I may see you there yet. Egwene made a vexed sound. It was a remarkable plan, the sort of thing Swan might devise, and hardly a scheme she thought Roedran Almaric do Araloa a Naloi could carry off. The fellow was said to be so dissolute he made Matt look wholesome. But then it was hardly a scheme she would have believed Roedran could think up. The only certainty was that Talmanis had made up his mind. I want your word, Talmanis, that you won't let Roedran pull you into a war. Responsibility,
The narrow stole around her neck seemed to weigh 10 times more than her cloak. If he moves sooner than you think, you will leave whether or not Matt has joined you.
I wish I could promise, but it is not possible, he protested. I expect the first raid against my foragers 3 days at most after I start moving away from Lord Bryn's army. Every lordling and farmer will think he can pick up a few horses in the night, give me a pinprick, and run off to hide.
I'm not talking about defending yourself, and you know it, she said firmly. Your word, Talmanus, or I will not allow your agreement with Roedron. The only way to stop it was to betray it, but she would not leave a war in her wake, a war she had started by bringing Talmanus here. Staring at her as if for the first time, he finally bent his head. Strangely, that seemed more formal than his bow had.
It will be as you say, Mother. Tell me, are you sure you are not Taviren, too?
I am the Ammerlin Seat, she replied. That is quite enough for anyone. She touched his arm again. The light shine on you, Talmanus. His smile nearly touched his eyes this time. Inevitably, despite their whispers, their talk had been noticed, maybe because of their whispers. The girl who claimed to be Ammerlin, a rebel against the White Tower, in conversation with the leader of 10,000 Dragonsworn. Had she made Talmanus's scheme with Roedron harder or easier? Was war in Murundi less likely or more? Swan and her bloody law of unintended consequences. 50 gazes followed her, then darted away as she moved through the crowd, warming her fingers on her cup. Well, most darted away. The sitters' faces were all ageless Aes Sedai's serenity, but Lelaine might have been a brown-eyed crow watching a fish struggle in the shallows, while Romanda's slightly darker eyes could have drilled holes through iron. Trying to keep a watch on the sun outside, she made a slow circuit through the pavilion. The nobles were still importuning sitters, but they moved from one to another as if seeking better answers, and she began to notice small things. Donal paused on his way from Janya to Moria, bowing low to Aemlyn, who acknowledged him with a gracious nod. Sean, turning away from Takima, curtsied deeply to Pelivar and received a slight bow in return. There were others, always a Murandian deferring to an Andoran, who responded just as formally. The Andorans tried to ignore Bryn except for the odd scowl, but any number of Murandians sought him out, one by one and well away from everyone else, and from the directions their eyes went, it was plain they were discussing Pelivar or Arathel or Aemlyn. Perhaps Talmanus had been right. She received bows and curtsies, too, though none so deep as those given Arathel and Pelivar and Aemlyn, much less the sitters. Half a dozen women told her how thankful they were that matters had been resolved peacefully, though in truth almost as many made noncommittal noises or shrugged uneasily when she expressed the same sentiment, as though they were uncertain it all would end peacefully. Her assurances that it would were met with a fervent, "The light send it so," or a resigned, "If the light wills." 4 called her mother, 1 without hesitating first. 3 others said that she was quite lovely, that she had beautiful eyes, and that she had a graceful carriage, in that order. Suitable compliments, perhaps, for Egwene's age, but not her station. At least she found 1 unalloyed pleasure. Segan was not alone in being intrigued by her announcement concerning the novice book. Plainly that was why most of the women spoke to her in the first place. After all, the other sisters might be in rebellion against the tower, but she claimed to be the Ammerlin Seat. Their interest had to be strong to overcome that, though no one wanted to let it show. Arathel made the inquiry with a frown that put more creases in her cheeks. Aemlyn shook her graying head at the answer. Blocky Shan asked, followed by a sharp-faced Andoran lady named Nagara, then a pretty big-eyed Murandian called Jennet, and others. None wanted to know for herself. Several made that clear quickly, especially the younger women, but before long every single noblewoman there had asked, and several servants as well, under cover of offering more spiced wine. 1, a wiry woman named Nildra, had come from the Aes Sedai camp. Egwene felt quite pleased with the seed she had planted there. She was not so pleased with the men. A few spoke to her, but only when they came face to face and seemed to have no other choice. A murmured word about the weather, either praising the end of the drought or deploring the sudden snows, a muttered hope that the bandit problem would end soon, perhaps with a significant look toward Talmanis, and they slipped away like greased pigs. A bear of an Andoran by the name of Makaran tripped over his own boots to avoid her. In a way, it was hardly surprising. The women had the justification, if only to themselves, of the novice book, but the men had only the thought that being seen conversing with her might tar them with the same brush. It was really quite discouraging. She did not care what the men thought about novices, but she very much wanted to know if they were as fearful as the women that this would come to blows in the end. Fears like that could fulfill themselves very easily. At last she decided there was only one way to find out. Pellivar turned from taking a fresh cup of wine from a tray and started back with a muffled oath to keep from bumping into her. Had she stood any closer, she would have had to stand on his boots. Hot wine splashed over his gloved hand and ran down under his coat sleeve, producing a curse not so muted. Tall enough to loom over her, he made a good job of it. His scowl belonged on a man wanting to send an annoying young woman briskly out of his way, or on a man who had nearly stepped on a red adder. She held herself erect and focused on an image of him as a small boy up to no good. That always helped. Most men seemed to feel it. He muttered something, it might have been a polite greeting or another oath, and dipped his head slightly, then tried to step around her. She sidestepped to stay in front of him. He moved back, and she followed. He began to look hunted. She decided to try putting him at ease before pressing the important question. She wanted answers, not more mumbling. "You must be pleased to hear that the daughter heir is on her way to Camelin, Lord Pellivar." She had heard several of the sitters mention that. His face went blank. "Elaine Trakand has a right to put in her claim to the Lion Throne," he replied in a flat voice. Egwene's eyes widened, and he stepped back again, uncertainly. Perhaps he thought her angry over the absence of her title, but she barely noticed that. Pellivar had supported Elaine's mother in her claim for the throne, and Elaine had been sure he would support her, too. She spoke of Pellivar fondly, like a favorite uncle. "Mother," Swan murmured at her elbow, "we must leave if you want to be sure of reaching the camp before sunset." She managed to put considerable urgency into those quiet words. The sun had passed its peak. "This is no weather to be in the open at nightfall," Pellivar said hurriedly. "If you will excuse me, I must make ready to leave." Shoving his cup onto the tray of a passing servant, he hesitated before halfway making a leg and stalked off with the air of a man who had wriggled free of a trap. Egwene wanted to grind her teeth with frustration. What did the men think of their agreement? If it could be called that, the way she had forced it on them. Arathel and Aemlyn had more power and influence than most of the men, yet it was Pellivar and Coolhan and the like who rode with the soldiers. They could still make this flare up in her face like a barrel of lamp oil. "Find Shiriam," she growled, "and tell her to get everyone mounted now, no matter what it takes." She could not give the sitters a night to think about what had happened today, to plan and plot. They had to be back in camp before the sun went down. Chapter 19. The Law. Getting the sitters to their mounts proved no bother. They were as eager to be away as Egwene, especially Romanda and Lilaine, both cold as the wind and with eyes like thunderclouds. The rest were the very image of cool-eyed Aes Sedai serenity, giving off composure like a heavy scent, yet they glided to their horses so quickly that the nobles were left gaping, and the brightly clad servants scrambled in loading the pack horses to catch up as best they could. Egwene had Dyshar set a hard pace in the snow, and with no more than a look and a nod from her, Lord Bryn made sure the armored escorts moved as fast. Swan on Bella and Shiriam on Wing rushed to join her. For long stretches they churned through fetlock deep cover, the horses stepping high at near to a trot, the flame of Tarvalen rippling in the icy breeze, and even when it was necessary to slow, when the horses were sinking knee-deep through the snow crust, they kept to a fast walk. The sitters had no choice except to keep up, and their speed cut down their opportunity to talk on the way. At that tiring pace, a lack of attention to your horse could bring a broken leg for the animal and a broken neck for you. Even so, Romanda and Lilaine each managed to gather her coterie around her, and those two knots floundered through the snow surrounded by wards against eavesdropping. The pair seemed to be delivering tirades. Egwene could imagine the topic. For that matter, other sitters managed to ride together for a time, exchanging a few words quietly and casting cool glances sometimes at her and sometimes at the sisters wrapped around by Sidar. Only Delana never joined one of those brief conversations. She stayed close beside Halima, who at last admitted that she was cold. Face tight, the countrywoman held her cloak close around her, but she still tried to comfort Delana, whispering to her almost constantly. Delana seemed to need comforting. Her brows were drawn down, putting a crease in her forehead that actually made her seem aged. She was not the only one worried. The others masked the feeling rigidly, radiating absolute poise, but the warders rode like men expecting the worst to leap out of the snow at the next step, eyes shifting in an unceasing watch, disquieting cloaks streaming in the wind to leave hands free. When an Aes Sedai worried, her warder worried, and the sitters were too absorbed to think of calming the men. Egwene was just as glad to see it. If the sitters were troubled, they had not yet made up their minds. When Bryn rode out to confer with Uno, she took the opportunity to ask what the two women had learned about Aes Sedai and tower guards in Andor. "Not much," Swan replied in a tight voice. Shaggy Bella did not seem to be having any difficulty with the pace, but Swan did, gripping her reins tightly in one hand and the pommel of her saddle with the other. "As near as I can make out, there are 50 rumors and no facts. It's a likely sort of tale to spring up, but it might still be true." Bella lurched, her front hooves sinking deep, and Swan gasped, "The light burn all horses!" Shiriam had learned no more. She shook her head and sighed irritably. "It sounds all feathers and nonsense to me, Mother. There are always rumors of sisters sneaking about." "Didn't you ever learn to ride, Swan?" she added, her voice suddenly dripping derision. "By tonight you'll be too sore to walk." Shiriam's nerves must have been ragged for her to burst out so openly. From the way she kept shifting in her saddle, she had already achieved her prediction for Swan. Swan's eyes hardened, and she opened her mouth, already half snarling, never mind who was watching from behind the banner. "Be still, both of you," Egwene snapped. She took a deep, calming breath. She was a bit ragged herself. Whatever Arathel believed, any force Elida sent to interfere with them would be too large for sneaking. That left the Black Tower, a disaster in the making. You got further plucking the chicken in front of you than trying to start on one up a tree, especially when the tree was in another country, and there might not even be another chicken. Still, she bit off her words in giving Shiriam instructions for once they reached the camp. She was the Ammerlin seat, and that meant all Aes Sedai were her responsibility, even those following Elida. Her voice was rock-steady, though. It was too late to be frightened once you grabbed the wolf by the ears. Shiriam's tilted eyes went wide at the orders. "Mother, if I may ask, why—" She trailed off under Egwene's level gaze and swallowed. "It will be as you say, Mother," she said slowly. "Strange. I remember the day you and Nynaeve came to the tower, two girls who couldn't decide whether to be excited or frightened. So much has changed since then. Everything." "Nothing stays the same forever," Egwene told her. She gave Swan a significant look, but Swan refused to see. She appeared to be sulking. Shiriam looked sick. Lord Bryn returned then, and he must have sensed the mood among them. Aside from saying that they were making good time, he kept his mouth shut. A wise man. Making good time or not, the sun was sitting almost on the treetops when they finally rode through the army's sprawling camp. Wagons and tents cast long shadows across the snow, and a number of men were hard at work building yet more low shelters out of brush. There were not nearly enough tents, even for all the soldiers, and the camp held almost as many harness-makers and laundresses and fletchers and the like, all those who inevitably followed any army. The ringing of anvils spoke of farriers and armorers and blacksmiths still at their labors. Cook-fires were burning everywhere, and the cavalry peeled away, eager for warmth and hot food, as soon as their wearily plodding animals were cared for. Surprisingly, Bryn rode on at Egwene's side after she dismissed him. "If you will allow, Mother," he said, "I thought I might accompany you a while longer." Shiriam actually twisted in her saddle to stare in astonishment. Swan stared too, straight ahead, as if not daring to turn her suddenly wide eyes toward him. What did he think he could do? Act as her bodyguard? Against sisters? That fellow with the drippy nose would do as well. Reveal just how completely he was on her side? Tomorrow was time enough for that, if all went well tonight. That revelation now might easily stampede the hall in directions she hardly dared contemplate. "Tonight is for Aes Sedai business," she told him firmly. But silly as the suggestion was, he had offered to put himself at risk for her. There was no telling his reasons. Who knew why a man did anything? Yet she owed him for that, among other things. "Unless I send Swan to you tonight, Lord Bryn, you should leave before morning. If blame for today attaches itself to me, it might reflect on you, too. Staying could prove dangerous, even fatal. I don't think they would need much excuse." No need to name who they were. "I gave my word," he replied quietly, patting Traveler's neck, "to Tarvalin." Pausing, he glanced toward Swan. It was less a hesitation than a consideration. "Whatever tonight's business is," he said finally, "remember that you have 30,000 men and Gareth Bryn behind you. That should count for something even among Aes Sedai. Until tomorrow, Mother." Reining his big-nosed bay around, he called over his shoulder, "I expect to see you tomorrow too, Swan. Nothing changes that." Swan stared at his back as he rode away. There was anguish in her eyes. Egwene could not help staring, too. He had never been so open before, not nearly. Why now, of all times? Crossing the 40 or 50 paces that separated the army's camp from the Aes Sedai's, she nodded to Shiriam, who drew rein at the first tents. She and Swan rode on. Behind them, Shiriam's voice rose, surprisingly clear and steady. "The Ammerlin seat calls the hall to sit this day in formal session. Let preparations be made with all speed." Egwene did not look back. At her tent, a bony groom, kicking her layered woolen skirts, came running to take Dyshar and Bella. Her face was pinched, and she barely ducked her head before hurrying away with the horses as quickly as she had come. The warmth of the glowing braziers inside was like a fist closing down. Egwene had not realized how cold it was outside until then, or how cold she was. Chesa took her cloak and exclaimed when she felt her hands, "Why, you're ice to the bone, Mother!" Chattering away, she bustled around, folding Egwene's cloak and Swan's, smoothing the neatly turned-down blankets on Egwene's cot, touching a tray set on one of the chests that had been pulled down from the stack. "I'd jump right into bed with hot bricks all around if I was that chilled, as soon as I'd eaten, anyway. Warm outside does only so much good without warm inside. I'll fetch a few extra bricks to tuck under your feet while you sup. And for Swan Sedai, of course. Oh, if I was as hungry as you must be, I know I'd be tempted to gulp my food, but that always gives me pains in the stomach." Pausing by the tray, she eyed Egwene, and nodded with satisfaction when she said that she would not eat too fast. Making a sober answer was not easy. Chesa was always refreshing, but after today, Egwene almost laughed with pleasure. There were no complications to Chesa. Two white bowls of lentil stew stood on the tray, along with a tall pitcher of spiced wine, two silver cups, and two large rolls. Somehow the woman had known Swan would be eating with her. Steam rose from the bowls and pitcher. How often had Chesa had to change that tray to make sure warm food greeted Egwene straight away? Simple and uncomplicated, and as caring as a mother or a friend. "I must forego bed for now, Chesa. I've work yet tonight. Would you leave us?" Swan shook her head as the tent flap fell behind the plump woman. "Are you sure she hasn't been in your service since you were a babe?" she muttered. Taking one of the bowls, a roll, and a spoon, Egwene settled into her chair with a sigh. She also embraced the source and warded the tent against listeners. Unfortunately, Sidar made her all that much more aware of half-frozen hands and feet. The bits in between were not much warmer. The bowl seemed almost too warm to handle, and the roll as well. Oh, how she would have loved to have those hot bricks! "Is there anything more we can do?" she asked, and promptly gulped down a spoonful of stew. She was ravenous, and no wonder, with nothing since breakfast and that early. Lentils and woody carrots tasted like her mother's finest cooking. I can't think of anything, but can you? Whatever can be done has been. There isn't anything else, short of the Creator putting a hand in. Swan took the other bowl and dropped onto the low stool, but then she sat staring into her stew and stirring it with her spoon.
You wouldn't really tell him, would you? She said finally.
I couldn't bear if he knew.
Why on earth not?
He'd take advantage, Swan said darkly. Oh, not that. I don't think that.
She was quite prudish in some areas.
But the man would make my life the pit of doom.
And washing his small clothes and polishing his boots and his saddle every day was not?
Egwene sighed. How could such a sensible, intelligent, capable woman turn into a scatterbrain over this one subject? Like a hissing viper, an image rose in her head. Herself, sitting on Gawain's knee, playing kissing games. In a tavern! She shoved it away hard.
Swan, I need your experience. I need your brain. I can't afford to have you half-witted because of Lord Bryn.
If you can't pull yourself together, I'll pay him what you owe and forbid you to see him. I will. I said I'd work off the debt, Swan said stubbornly. I have as much honor as Lord Gareth Bloody Bryn, as much and more. He keeps his word and I keep mine. Besides, Min told me I have to stay close to him or we'll both die, or something like that.
A pinkness in her cheeks gave her away, though.
Her honor and Min's viewing notwithstanding, she was simply willing to put up with anything to be near the man.
Very well.
You're besotted, and if I tell you to stay away from him, you'll either disobey or mope and wrap the rest of your brains in a cloud. What are you going to do about him? Scowling indignantly, Swan went on for some little time, growling what she would like to do about Gareth Bloody Bryn. He would have enjoyed none of it. Some he might not have survived.
Swan, Egwene said warningly,
you deny one more time what's plain as your nose, and I'll tell him and give him the money.
Swan pouted sullenly.
She pouted. Sullenly. Swan!
I don't have time to be in love. I barely have time to think between working for you and him, and even if everything goes right tonight, I'll have twice as much to do.
Besides, her face fell and she shifted on the stool.
What if he doesn't return my feelings? She muttered. He's never even tried to kiss me. All he cares about is whether his shirts are clean.
Egwene scraped her spoon through her bowl and was surprised when it came up empty. Nothing remained of the roll but a few crumbs on her dress.
Light! Her middle still felt hollow.
She eyed Swan's bowl hopefully. The woman seemed to have little interest in anything but drawing circles in the lentils.
A sudden thought occurred to her.
Why had Lord Bryn insisted that Swan work off her debt even after learning who she was? Just because she had said she would? It was a preposterous arrangement. Except that it did keep her close to him when nothing else would have. For that matter, she herself had often wondered why Bryn had agreed to build the army. He had to have known there was a very good chance he was laying his head on the chopping block. And why he had offered that army to her, a girl Ammerlin with no real authority and not a friend among the sisters except Swan, as far as he knew. Could the answer to all of these questions be as simple as, he loved Swan? No. Most men were frivolous and flighty, but that was truly preposterous. Still, she offered the suggestion, if only to amuse Swan. It might cheer her a little. Swan snorted in disbelief. It sounded odd coming from that pretty face, but no one could put quite so much expression into a snort as she did. He's not a total idiot, she said dryly. In fact, he has a good head on his shoulders. He thinks like a woman most of the time.
I still haven't heard you say you'll straighten up, Swan, Egwene persisted.
You have to, one way or another. Well, of course I will. I don't know what's been the matter with me. It isn't as if I never kissed a man before.
Her eyes narrowed suddenly, as if she expected Egwene to challenge her on that.
I haven't spent my whole life in the tower. This is ridiculous. Chattering about men tonight of all nights.
Peering into her bowl, she seemed to realize for the first time that it held food. She filled her spoon,
gesturing with it at Egwene. "You have to be careful of your timing, more now than ever. If Romanda or Lelaine grabs the tiller, you'll never get your hands on it." Ridiculous or not, something certainly had restored Swan's appetite. She went through her stew faster than Egwene had hers, and not a crumb of the roll escaped her. Egwene found that she had drawn her fingers through her own empty bowl. There was nothing for it then but to lick off the last few lentils, of course. Discussing what was to happen tonight served no real point. They had honed and refined what Egwene was to say and when so many times that she was surprised she had not dreamed of it. She certainly could have done her part in her sleep. Swan insisted anyway, skirting very near the point where Egwene would have to call her down, going over it again and again, bringing up possibilities they had discussed before 100 times. Strangely, Swan had found herself a very good mood. She even essayed a little humor, unusual for her of late, though some was on the gallows side. "You know, Romanda wanted to be Amarlin herself once," she said at one point. "I've heard it was Tamra getting the stole and staff that made her stalk off into retirement like a gull with her tail feathers clipped. I'll lay a silver mark I don't have to a fish scale that her eyes bulge twice as much as Lelaine's. And later, I wish I could be there to hear them howl. Somebody's going to before much longer, and I'd rather it was them than us. I never had the voice for singing." She actually sang a little snatch about staring across the river at a boy and having no boat. She was right. Her voice was pleasant in its fashion, but she could not carry a tune in a bucket. And later still, "A good thing I have such a sweet face now. If this goes badly, they'll dress the pair of us for dolls and sit us on a shelf to admire. Of course we might have accidents instead. Dolls do get broken. Gareth Bryn will have to find someone else to bully." She really laughed at that. Egwene felt considerable relief when the tent flap bulged inward briefly, announcing someone who knew enough not to enter where there was a ward. She really did not want to hear where Swan's humor went from there. As soon as she released the ward, Shiriam stepped inside, accompanied by a rush of air that seemed 10 times as cold as earlier. "It's time, Mother. Everything is ready." Her tilted eyes were wide, and she licked her lips with the tip of her tongue. Swan bounded to her feet and seized her cloak from Egwene's cot, but she paused in the act of draping it on her shoulders. "I have sailed the fingers of the dragon in the dark, you know," she said seriously, "and netted a lionfish once with my father. It can be done." Shiriam frowned as Swan darted out, letting in more cold. "Sometimes I think," she began, but whatever she sometimes thought, she did not share. "Why are you doing this, Mother?" she asked instead. "All of it. Today at the lake, calling the hall tonight. Why did you have us spend all day yesterday talking about Loghain to everybody we met? I'd think you might share it with me. I am your keeper. I did swear fealty." "I tell you what you need to know," Egwene said, swinging her cloak around her shoulders. There was no need to say that she trusted a forced oath only so far, even a sister's. And Shiriam might find a reason to let a word slip into the wrong ear, despite that oath. After all, Aes Sedai were noted for finding loopholes in what they had said. She did not really believe that would happen, but just as with Lord Bryn, she could not take even small chances unless she had to. "I have to tell you," Shiriam said bitterly. "I think tomorrow Romanda or Lelaine will be your keeper of the Chronicles, and I'll be serving a penance for not warning the hall, and I think you might envy me." Egwene nodded. "All too possible. Shall we go?" The sun made a red dome on the treetops to the west, and a lurid light shone off the snow. Servants marked Egwene's passage along the deep paths with silent bows and curtsies. Their faces were troubled or else blank. Servants could pick up the moods of those they served almost as quickly as warders. Not a sister was to be seen at first, and then they all were, in a great gathering 3 deep around a pavilion set up in the only open space in the camp large enough, the area used by sisters skimming to the dovecotes in Saladar and traveling back with reports from the eyes and ears. A large, much-mended piece of heavy canvas, not a patch on the splendor of the canopy at the lake. It had been a great deal of effort to set up. Most often in the past 2 months the hall had convened much as they had yesterday morning, or perhaps squeezed into one of the larger tents. The pavilion had been erected only twice since leaving Saladar, both times for a trial. Noticing Egwene and Shiriam's approach, sisters in the back murmured to those ahead, and a gap opened to let them through. Expressionless eyes watched the pair of them, giving not a clue to whether the watching sisters knew or even suspected what was happening. Not a clue to what they thought. Butterflies stirred in Egwene's stomach. A rosebud. Calm. She stepped onto the layered carpets, woven in bright flowers and a dozen different patterns, and moved through the ring of braziers set up around the canopy's rim, and Shiriam began. "She comes! She comes!" If she sounded a little less grand than usual, a touch nervous, it was small wonder. The polished benches and cloth-covered boxes from the lake were in use again. They made a much more formal sight than the mismatched gaggle of chairs that had been used previously. Two slanting lines of nine grouped by threes, green, gray, and yellow to one side, white, brown, and blue to the other. At the wide end, farthest from Egwene, stood the striped box and bench for the Amarlin seat. Sitting there, she would be the focus of every eye, very much aware that she was one, facing 18. As well, she had not changed her clothes. Every sitter still wore her finery from the lake, only adding her shawl. A rosebud. Calm. One of the benches was empty, though only for a moment longer. Delana came rushing in just as Shiriam finished her litany. Looking breathless and flustered, the gray sitter scrambled up to her seat, between Varalyn and Quamesa, with little of her usual grace. She wore a sickly grin and toyed nervously with the fire drops around her neck. Anyone might have thought she was the one on trial. Calm. No one was on trial. Yet. Egwene started slowly across the carpets between two rows, with Shiriam close behind, and Quamesa stood. The light of Saidar suddenly shone around the dark, slender woman, youngest of the sitters. Tonight there would be no skimping of the formalities. "What is brought before the Hall of the Tower is for the Hall alone to consider," Quamesa announced. "Whosoever intrudes unbidden, woman or man, initiate or outsider, whether they come in peace or in anger, I will bind according to the law, to face the law. Know that what I speak is true, it will and shall be done." That formula was older than the oath against speaking untruth, from a time when almost as many Amarlins died by assassination as by all other causes put together.